is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Financial Times headline these last hours. Xi Jinping's G20 snub sparks concern of retreat from international diplomacy. This is London reporting. Recall that Europe has a complicated and not entirely logical approach to China and doing business with China. This is not the same as the U.S. foreign policy, and I call upon Mary Kissel, my colleague, to comment on this Financial Times approach to the recently concluded G20 in India, attended by President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and other G20 leaders, excepting two. That would be Xi Jinping, as noted in the headline, and Vladimir Putin, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court for allegations of being a war criminal. Mary, a very good evening to you. Thank you from this. What we have here is a puzzle about Xi retreating, snubbing. There are many ways to approach this. One suggestion, this is Delhi, is that it was meant to insult the host, Narendra Modi, who is in re-election mode always, because of the conflict in the high Himalayas and the general enmity between these two super states since China's predation became impossible to ignore. That's one explanation. Another explanation is that there's trouble at home. I don't ask you to choose. Let's take them in order. Is Xi Jinping insulting Narendra Modi, and is that purposeful in your measure? Good evening to you, Mary.
Good evening to you, John. Yes, it is insulting if a national leader doesn't show up at a major international event, even if said event doesn't accomplish all that much of note. Look at the uproar, for instance, when the U.S. president doesn't bother to attend the East Asia summit, which happens periodically. It is seen as an insult. But you're right, John. We really don't know why Xi Jinping didn't appear. You named two very reasonable possibilities, but there's a third. He could also be sick, or a fourth, in that there's some sort of leadership coup underway. We just don't know. It's a very opaque system. I think there were a couple of interesting things, though, about that Financial Times article that you mentioned. The first is that there's an assumption that the G20 is a useful and productive entity. I think that's very debatable. It's full of countries that don't share common values or strategic goals because it's populated both with democracies and corrupt authoritarian or even totalitarian regimes. But the second interesting thing, which I thought was great about the article, is that for the very first time, I've seen a major newspaper report on events and activities within China and tell the truth, give context for readers about the people that they're quoting. Just to give you one example, the journalist Joe Leahy, I used to know him from my time in Hong Kong. He's a longtime Asia hand. He cites something called the Chinese Institutes of Contemporary International Relations think tank. But then he gives a parenthesis and he says, quote, which is affiliated with Beijing's spy agency, the Ministry of State Security. John, this is a step forward for the media to give that important context so that when readers think they're getting, quote, you know, Beijing government point of view, what it actually is propaganda. And that's exactly what Joe, writing for the Financial Times, is telling the reader. So that's good and important. But just to circle back to where you started, yeah, we don't know why he wasn't there, but it is considered insulting for the host.
And the explanation that she has trouble at home, not coup level, let's say that the economy is now going through a bad patch that China has not yet come up with an explanation or a solution to. But is not it true that Xi Jinping is the big boss, that Li Qiang, the man who did attend the G20, is charged with the economy? I know it all is all one, but the economy right now, in your measure, Mary, we see routinely bearish predictions for the Chinese market ahead. Is that enough to rattle Xi to stay away from G20? After all, trade is the way out.
Well, we don't. Again, we're only speculating here, but certainly Xi Jinping was brought in to reassert the party's control over domestic industry and foreigners operating within mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau. And he's done that. The trade-off is, of course, slower growth and more corruption and more concentration of decision-making within Xi Jinping's office and for Xi Jinping himself. And everyone knows, just from history, you can look at data, that when you have a single individual making economic decisions for a very large economy, that's going to be far less efficient and productive than millions and hundreds of millions of people making their own decisions about capital allocation in, say, a capitalist democracy. So it looks to me that the party has accepted that outcome as a necessary condition for reasserting party control. And Xi Jinping has proved himself a very brutal person in enacting that strategy. Look at the number of people who have been purged, starting with Hu Jintao in a very public fashion, where he was marched off the stage, the party congress, a former leader of China, continuing with Qin Gong, the foreign minister, who just disappeared in June. God knows what's happened to him. The head of the rocket forces, which contain the land-based nuclear forces, his deputy, all gone. Never mind all of the activists and Peng Shui, the tennis star, and others who just, poof, they're gone. So I think Xi Jinping, much in the same fashion as Vladimir Putin, is sending a very clear message that if you mess with him or you challenge his power, bad things are going to happen. So I think there's an incorrect assumption on behalf of many Western analysts that, well, he must change course because the economy is slowing down. No. That's not the point. The party's control is the point, and he has many tools in his power to keep social unrest at bay, and he's going to use them. He is using them. So there's a lot of pain in a nation, and he doesn't care a whit about, you know, the good of the, what's good for the Chinese people, what's good for him and what's good for the party. And that's how he makes decisions.
More stirring of tea leaves. The president of the United States did attend G20 and then also stopped in Vietnam, where he held a press conference making remarks about China. I don't want to contain China, said Mr. Biden at a press conference as he was leaving Asia. I just want to make sure we have a relationship with China that is on the up and up, squared away. Everybody knows what it's all about. NBC goes on to give this quote. We're not looking to hurt China, sincerely. We're all better off if China does well. I'm puzzled, Mary. China is an adversary of our allies. It directly threatens Taiwan. It directly threatens India. I could go on. So how is it that the president is presenting us? Is this carrot? Or is this carrot without a stick? Can you tell?
Well, I think as we've discussed before on your show, the United States is suffering from what I would call a strategic confusion about our relationship with the Chinese Communist Party-led regime in Beijing and what our interests are. We also suffer from some form of strategic narcissism where we think that what we do is what matters, and we don't really take into account what the other side is doing and willing to do. China, under the current totalitarian form, has absolutely no interest in developing a healthier, more stable relationship. They want to dominate us. But the U.S. government has not yet concluded that China is an adversary, as you say. And so you get these confused statements that the world would do better if China did better. Well, we love the Chinese people. We should always say that. But the world will not do better if the ruling Chinese Communist Party is enriched and enabled. And, you know, the current administration is not willing to say that because that would create an enormous amount of trouble for them. It would require a retooling of many parts of our government, perhaps not DOD or the intel agencies, which have known that China is an adversary for many, many, many years, if not decades. But it would require a fundamental reordering of how we trade, how many, you know, who do we have in the country? Is it safe for them to be there? Do we need to tell American executives to get out? How do we rally our allies? What's the role of the State Department? Do we cut them off from, or try to cut them off from development funding from the World Bank and others? What are we going to do about them and their role at the UN? It just raises hundreds and hundreds of very important questions. And I just don't think that we're there yet. I think it's unfortunate, but it's going to take some kind of crisis to jolt the U.S. government into a more forward-leaning and realistic stance about what we're dealing with and what their intentions are. It's so that makes this period of time very, very dangerous. And it creates an opening for China to, make a lot of mischief, if not start an open conflict in the Pacific. I hope I'm wrong, John, but when you hear statements like that from the U.S. president, I think it's very concerning because it just doesn't reflect the reality of what we're dealing with.
You've educated me over these years, Mary, that in meetings with Chinese diplomats around Xi Jinping and around Li or their predecessors, that the diplomats present themselves as grim-faced, hostile, arrogant, presumptive, condescending, imperial. In short, they act as if they are already the most powerful state on the planet. And therefore, I'm trying to learn how flattering them or flattering China advances the case that China has gone too far. Hong Kong is too far, Mary.
Yeah, I mean, we've just witnessed the first Chinese domination of a democracy. I mean, that's really what it was. And it won't be the last. And flattering them doesn't work. History tells us that. That's not a hypothesis. We can look at the results of the Obama approach versus the Trump approach versus the softer now Biden approach, and it doesn't work. And the reason they behave that way in diplomatic meetings, John, is because we're allowing that to happen. We would never, ever make an exception like that for the likes of, say, Germany. State Department would freak out. That's the technical term. They'd freak out. They would not tolerate it. They would walk out. They would say, you better be nice to us. Look at all the money we're pouring in and the tens of thousands of troops we have on your soil to protect you. Goodbye. But for some reason, and maybe it's a bit of prejudice here, John, that China has been viewed for more than 100 years as this exotic, faraway place with a very difficult language and an entirely foreign culture to us, that somehow they're magical and we must treat them differently. And it's really messed up our diplomacy. It's confused us. And we have an entire cadre of people in the U.S. government who have now been acclimated to treating China differently for decades. And that needs to change. And it has to be changed from the top. That's not to say that there aren't people within the State Department that get it. There are. But if this strategic change isn't enforced at the top, then they're just going to revert to form, which is a form of appeasement, which doesn't work.
Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, return to the war in Europe, and the debate that is at hand about continued aid by NATO, by the United States, to a troubled land. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick.